Welcome to a new episode of Artist on Air. Today I'm recording in English, so you can guess that we have an international guest. I decided to bring in Luca Cartaccini on the show, the CEO and founder of Shop Circle, who has a very clear yet huge mission to build a European-based B2B software powerhouse. So what are the KPIs here? They have raised 250 million euros in funding over the last 5 years. They have acquired more than 16 companies by now, and they have a special edge in operational excellence and applying AI both internally on their own efficiency, but also using AI to accelerate growth at the acquired companies. I wish you a lot of fun with Shop Circle number one, 45 minutes, Luca Cartaccini. Let's go. Artist on Air, the podcast for B2B software and AI founders in the German-speaking region. Compiled by Janis Bondorski, Julius Göllner and Matthias Ernst. And then, very quickly before we jump in the podcast, quick shout out to our ecosystem partner Float, without whom this podcast wouldn't be possible. Float is a game changer for funding SaaS businesses, no matter the occasion, whether you're looking to extend your runway or invest in growth. They've got flexible funding options for all your needs. If you're looking for a funding partner that truly understands your needs, talk to Float, meet Janis or Cedric at the Artist Summit on the 9th of October, or contact Janis directly at janis@gofloat.io. Hi, Luca. Welcome to the Artist on Air podcast. I'm really excited having you. We usually record for the DACH region and the German-speaking audience, but once in a while, I like to introduce an external story, international story. And since you were with your company, Shop Circle, just published as one of the top 100 rising SaaS companies in Europe, I'm really excited having you. And without further ado, let me ask you to explain yourself. Like, what is Shop Circle? What do you do?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Matthias, and thank you everyone for listening. Danke. I think it's appropriate to say. So, what do we do at Shop Circle? So, Shop Circle is a technology company powering the modern infrastructure of enterprises, which, in other words, means we made several acquisitions, all of them in the B2B software space. And now we have tools spanning from what is more front-end, so client-facing, so more in the marketing, recommendations, and other tools in that space, and more in the infrastructure space as well. So what we call back-end tools, which could be developer tools, API management, and so forth. Long story short is we now have a company with 30 products. Most of them were acquired rather than built from scratch. And the capital was essentially coming from external investors. So from day one, we made the conscious decision of raise external capital, a mix of American and European investors. We made several acquisitions, 16 to date, in a bit less than 4 years and a half. And we now have this comprehensive platform of tools. It's somewhat similar to names that you might know that are also active in the Dutch region, like Constellation Software, Visma, Aptain, and a few others. And the idea is really like to build one of the largest company in the space, in the B2B software space, because it's a massive market in Europe. And going there through a mix of like acquisitions and organic growth as well. On the back end, we basically are implementing AI across everything that we do on two sides. On the first side is more like to automate operation, because when you are such an acquisitive company, there are a lot of efficiencies that you can achieve before the acquisition, but also like after across the organization. Think about finance, HR, controlling all these repetitive tasks that over time you can automate. And we also have an additional task force or team that help us to implement AI and roll new features across the overall portfolio, which is often like an era where bootstrap founders don't have an expertise. Therefore, then they join a larger company, which has, you know, a specialized team, and help the companies to get faster and better when it comes to rolling out AI features as well. So long story short, we are a technology group or platform, and we serve like, you know, 100,000 enterprise across the globe with a focus on North America and Europe before everything else. I guess that's a summary of what ShipCircle does.
That's great. Like, so if I break that down into three topics that we can dive into further, right? So you buy and build, but you also buy a lot. You said 16 acquisition. So let's go into this M&A business later. Secondly, you said you do that by raising a lot of external money. And if my research is correct, you did about three rounds and overall like around 250 million that you raised. So that's, I'd say, quite successfully in raising money. So we can also look into that, especially like your launch, because that, I think there's a bit of an interesting story, like launching from a stealth mode with already around 60 million in funding. I haven't heard that, but it sounds like a cool playbook. So let's dive into that. And the third big topic I hear is AI, basically developing a spike in AI and then rolling that out to companies that you acquire, to basically have synergies there, right? Because you can use your internal skills and apply them to the new products that you acquire. Super, super interesting story. I mean, there's so much we can dive in. My main question always to founders is like, how did you get there? Like, how did you end up building ShopCircle? Like maybe we can spend 1 or 2 minutes on like where you're coming from, and especially on the moment of inception, like where did you have the idea from to start your company?
Sure, happy to do so. Matthias, like mostly come from my former career. So I started my career in equity research, covering the European tech sector. So I was in finance, but at the same time, I was covering the technology sector. And that gave me a strong understanding, I believe, of how software companies are valued and what late stage investors really care about. And later on, I moved to the other side of the table. So I started working in venture capital, where I had the chance to spend time with some great founders and entrepreneurs every day. And that was very inspiring because I realized I wanted to be one of them and not just advise them, and I could be one of them. And so when the opportunity came, I brought in, you know, my co-founder as well, Gian Maria. We met in business school back in 2014. So now it's 11 years ago. And he had a completely different background from mine. He brought more operational skills. So he was closer to operation in Amazon and other companies as well, specifically marketing, growth, and execution. And so we thought together, we had the perfect background to move into, like, you know, a technology acquisitive company to provide best class B2B software to most of the enterprise in Europe and in US as well, which are fairly behind when it comes to adoption to technology, especially in the most traditional industry. So that's how the idea came together. We raised the initial angel round. We decided to quit our full-time jobs, which was not an easy decision to do at the time, but at the same time, we were relatively young. And so we didn't have too much commitments. We didn't have too many expenses, a bit of saving from, let's say, 7-8 years of past experience. And it was the right time. Also, it was 2021. So access to capital was definitely easier. Let me put it this way.
Why was it the right time? Because as you said, like, maybe you were still young, but like, especially coming from a finance and VC career background, you probably earned quite a good salary, and that's what you meant, like leaving your day-to-day job is a bit of a hurdle. So how did you know, like, how did you feel like it was the right time?
I guess for both of us, we always wanted to start something on our own. We always liked the idea to be entrepreneurs, but in Europe, in order to be an entrepreneur, usually, and I'm not saying it's the right thing, in order to raise capital, you need to usually go somewhere else first, right? To get some experience, to get a stamp on your CV, especially like in Germany and other traditional economies, they care a lot of your past experience, although it was relatively short. And so once we gather that level of minimum experience that you need and work with the names that you might expect, you know, in such Amazon, I was at Jefferies in investment banking, then it become easier as well to fulfill our dream of actually being our entrepreneur ourselves. The period was relatively strange because we were in the middle of COVID. So we were working from home. And at the same time, like, you know, it was a good time to start a company because around 2020, overall, the VC market, despite initially right after COVID, the amount of funding raised in Europe increased every single year, I believe, from 2002 until 2020. So the access to the resources was also like easier. So combining this burning desire to be entrepreneurs to access to capital made it possible that it was the right time for us to start the company. But reality, Matthias, is that there is never like a right time, right? Every time that you leave your soft and comfortable full-time job, there is always something that you leave and there is always something that you might gain on the upside. But like, you know, once we started the company, for the several months, we didn't pay ourselves a salary, although we started with a funding round, but we wanted to use the capital to actually do useful things for the company rather than paying ourselves. So it's a compromise. Ultimately, there is never like a...
I 100% agree. Because there's never the right moment. I know so many people who just never start because they wait for something, you know, like that tells them now it's correct. And suddenly they are like, I don't know, in their 40s with two or three kids. And then it becomes even more difficult, right? Because the more dependencies you have,
That's exactly the way I see it. I think about it as well. It's, I mean, obviously, on one hand, it's more difficult to start it when you're in your 20s because you have less experience, so people trust you a bit less. But at the same time, it's really a demanding job, right? It's a full-time job, more than a full-time job. And it's difficult to do it once you have kids and commitment. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's more difficult to do it once you have more expenses and more time to dedicate to your family, obviously, right?
There are only you had the feeling, post-COVID, like the corporate job wasn't that cool anymore. There's capital in the market. You have gained your badge in terms of names and experience. Now you start the company. How did you figure out this business model that you're approaching now?
Yeah, sure. I've always been a nerd when it comes to, you know, finance applied to technology and business model. That was my job, right? I was covering listed businesses, so usually like more late stage in the technology space. So that gave me like a very good understanding of what works and what investors really care about. And my co-founder on the other side, he had a better understanding of what enterprise needed from a product and technology perspective. And so we combined the two different set of expertises, building something that is already proven in the market. So software buy and build is a very liquid asset class. There are several successful names globally. So for instance, you have Visma, which is going for an IPO next year for more than 20 billion. There is Constellation Software, which is an $80 billion market cap company. And they also have a couple of spin-off, which are both worth around $10 billion. So there are already like many successful stories, but all of these companies, they tend to have relatively different approach. They're more like patient capital, almost like private equity, financial people, whereas we wanted to bring a different twist. So we are product-led operators building a long-term software platform. And our edge really comes from execution and not financial engineer. So we have this repeatable playbook that combine, you know, operating leverage, AI integration, and deep vertical expertise, and we keep applying it towards several acquisitions. So it's almost like the traditional buy and build software model, but with an innovative modern spin. And is already proven in the market because there are several success cases and stories. And obviously, as you know very well, Matthias, the SaaS market is pretty large. So we believe that we can build a multi-billion outcome in the space.
Great. I love it. So if I got that correctly, you said like you have examples in the market that are already reaching, you know, valuations of a couple of billion, yeah, which is great. So there's
more than a couple, like Constellation, combining all the entities of Constellation, they're more than 100 billion.
Yeah, 100 billion, that's a good North Star. Yeah. So we're talking about a sizable vision. Yeah, that's good. And then you said it's a proven business model. You bring a spin, especially on execution, right? That's your USP. You do a little bit different than just having the capital and buying them together. Now, I mean, we are in the B2B software business with Artist, and we're talking to a lot of founders. And what I've figured is, B2B is so interesting because there's so many areas and niches you might never have thought about as a B2C customer, right? And then you listen to it, metals and mining, chemicals, I don't know, automotive sector. I've talked to so many founders who just cover like a very specific problem, but the problem itself is so huge, they make a couple of million in profit every year, which totally makes sense if you're founding with your brother and you're bootstrapped, you have a nice business, right? So, but there's so many different software solutions out there. So how do you approach that? Like, how do you say like, this is the next product I'm going to add to my portfolio?
Yeah, 100%. It's a mix of obviously we have a dedicated team of 7 M&A specialists who focus on this every day. And my background, as I mentioned before, like it's M&A, equity research, but really like screening the market and finding the best opportunities. But we apply a very clear framework. So, and when I say a very clear framework, is two fronts. So on the first one is more the opportunistic approach. So from a metrics perspective, and we usually look at what you might expect, right? We don't get overly creative, but we're very stubborn about these metrics. And usually we look at net dollar retention, organic growth is very important for us as well. Cohort health, so that there is the right diversification mix, EBITDA margins, cash flow, and LTV to CAC, but obviously in a more structured way. When it comes to, and usually we acquire, like, you know, our thesis is that we acquire companies that are post-product market fit, because we believe that at that point, they're much less risky, with usually at least 1.5 to 2 million ARR, and all the way up to around $15 million. And, you know, these ensure usually that there is a foundation to build on. And beyond the numbers, each acquisition has to fit a clear strategic story. So why we're acquiring it, what transformation we can drive post-deal, and how it fits into our operating playbook. Now, in plain English, then it also means that we take top-down approach on certain verticals based on how large is the market, because obviously for us, we're not bootstrapped. So we can't be happy with just like 1-2 million ARR. We need to have a more ambitious vision, because we raise capital from investor, and there is nothing wrong with bootstrap founders. We love them, actually, like most of our acquisitions were founders that never raised capital from investors. And I believe most founders, unless they have the opportunity to go after like a 1 billion opportunity, they should never raise capital from investor, especially now that it's easier to build and maintain software. But basically, like on top of the, you know, the strategic narrative, what we can do after the acquisition, and the more specific KPIs, it's very important for us to have a view on the sector, the space, and our consolidation within that as well.
But is there any like more like specific common theme? You mentioned before you have like a front end part of the company and the back end part, that makes sense. But you also mentioned marketing. You mentioned API connectors. I mean, that's a very broad area, right? So What's the next company you're looking for right now?
Yeah, it's a very broad area on purpose as well. But like within that, we do have a lot of specialization. So, for instance, we do usually like we divide, we split our two categories into business application and more like infrastructure tools. One is more backend and the other is more like client facing. And the latest acquisition that we've done is this company called Creek & Deep, which has been announced 2 days ago. And this belongs more to the infrastructure category. So Creek & Deep is an API management tool used in some of the most demanding API environments globally, including several Fortune 500 companies. So very, very enterprise. And acquiring it, it was a statement that we're serious about infrastructure, not just business application. And of course, you will see us to continue to expand into infrastructure while also continuing to strengthen our base of business application. But because the business model is decentralized by nature, you can afford to have different business units with different expertise as well. Now, going back to your question, of course, we have some recurring teams. So for instance, in the business application space, we have a lot of commerce software, like a lot of upselling, cross-selling tool, but also like more core functions such as inventory management and so forth. But we do have a strong expertise in the commerce space, and we're building the same in the developer tools as well. Now, obviously, they're both like huge markets, and the fact that we rely on very experienced manager when it comes to the day-to-day operation allow us to be broad in terms of market proposition.
And now you mentioned that you have 150,000 customers or above 100,000 customers in the B2B space. I imagine not all of these customers use the full suite that you offer, right? So there's probably a few only use one tool, then a few use a couple of tools, and then big enterprise customers might use almost all of them. So how do you describe your ideal customer profile, and did that evolve over time while you're growing your portfolio?
That's right. And because, Matthias, because we have different products, the customer profile can be very different. So The point that they have in common is that they're all businesses. So we don't do anything in the B2C space. Not because we don't like it, just because we like to have to specialize on B2B.
Yeah.
And within that, we have, you know, loads of SMB, small, medium enterprise, and a lot of like very enterprise clients. And the nature of the clients very much depends on the product that they're using as well. For instance, on Creek & Deep that I just mentioned, all the clients are enterprise, or most of them. In Aiden, which is another company that we own in the guided selling space, AI-powered guided selling space. So it's basically like going to website and having an assistant that help you to buy always the best products based on your preference and what you need and what is available in the market. Mm-hmm. They're also like mid-market enterprise, so they have large names such as Media Market, which is like a German one, and a few others of that size, very enterprise. But then we also have a few Shopify applications, which by nature, they're more done to serve, you know, small, medium enterprises as well of all sizes. So it could be a mom and pop shop of like 3-4 people, and it can be a very large one. But not necessarily we acquire a client with the idea of like them using all of our tools, right? And it's almost impossible to think that once you have a company with 30, 40 and potentially like, you know, 50 products by the end of next year, you don't want to just the client to be forced to use all our tools. But as you say, it's very common that we can, you know, get a client using several of our solution when there is a need. So we can serve as expert for the clients and actually recommend different solutions to them.
So I would imagine, imagine if you...
Exactly. So the size, Matthias, is very different. Like, you know, some of them can be around 2-3 million of turnover. Now, the latest acquisition that we've done are a bit more enterprise. And by enterprise, I usually mean $50,000 plus a year in terms of like B2B contracts for the solution that we join forces with recently.
I could imagine that if you acquire a new company, you also acquire their customers, and then it would be nice to bring those customers close to all your other products, right? By that, you can grow not only with every unorganical, but with every acquisition, you would also get some organical growth, right? Because the new customers can then use your existing portfolio on top, so you'd grow in two dimensions, which would be nice to accelerate.
That's right. Yes, that's right. I mean, only if it makes sense sure. for the client. But we have built a network of, 50 industry experts, of which, many are also working full time with the company across our core verticals, and they can help with pricing, go to market, product expansion after acquisition. But go to market is a core one, because especially when it comes to, and I'm speaking about B2B software, obviously, but when it comes to B2B software and you're dealing with bootstrap founders, which is the case many times for us, most of the times for us, they usually lack, they're usually like technical founders that lack some go-to-market expertise. So we really help with that after the acquisition, because suddenly they join a larger company with experts. So this is something that we've done repeatedly in our playbook across several acquisitions. So yes, you're right. Go-to-market and cross-selling are some of the areas where we can provide a lot of help.
Yeah, and maybe following on this one, because I parked this before, you said like you build an expertise in AI, which now, I mean, it's in everyone's top priority list, and you can help founders roll that out. Maybe we can dive into this a little bit deeper. So what's your perspective on AI, and how does it change B2B software in the next 2 years?
Yeah. So how do we look at AI? We basically either like there are two things that we do. Like on one hand, we centralize operation and embed AI to unlock efficiency and margin expansion as well. In that case, we either build or adopt tools. And, there are so many tools out there, which is almost like overwhelming. So we have people that are specialized in this to assess, speak with the vendor, and then implement as well the solution within the organization.
Can you give me one or two examples where you really like actually unlocked value? Because I mean,
shout out to the specific partners, but we do have a couple of like huge operators in the development tool space. What I mean is like writing code, reviewing of the code as well, QA. I can say we use Cursor across all our development team. And, the impact has been massive. I think for a relatively senior developer, productivity has increased up to 5 times in terms of like, efficiency and speed in writing code. We do have something from the marketing team as well. We also implemented AI when it comes to our AI M&A team. So origination and execution, it helped us a lot to screen the market very quickly, reach out to the right people. And then also when it comes to due diligence. And now we're trying to implement it more. So we are on a pilot with a vendor in marketing. So content generation, obviously we already do it with ChatGPT, Claude, and other LLM, but we're trying to test a more specific player. And also like when it comes to more tedious finance tasks, such as controlling and reporting. So that usually allows us to improve margins almost immediately because, you can get, let's assume you get a developer to be 4 times more efficient through tools. And that's just like, one example, obviously, can be applied to all the repetitive tasks that I mentioned before, marketing, HR, finance, and controlling. But like the margins uplift is almost immediate. And having a task force who's only like dedicated on that and only focusing on that really helps to look at it from a big picture, because we're all busy with our day-to-day jobs, right? And no one really has the time, unless they have the specific mandate to do that, to take a step back, assess what is available in the market, and actually test it on whether it works or not. Because our approach is always like, we have so many use cases for AI across the organization, and I only mentioned a few, that you need to prioritize the one where, based on the amount of investment that we make, what is the ROI, right?
Yeah.
And so having a person fully dedicated on that and a team fully dedicated on that massively help. And would you say
we recently had an interesting task? I was interviewing Florian Hübner von Überall, a German company. Said he implemented this KPI in the company. It's like how much percent or of your task you're using AI for per employee, because he figured there's like always a handful of tech heavy or tech savvy employees who love to embrace AI, but technically almost everyone in the company should not do everything with AI, but always consider, is there a chance of getting this job done easier using AI? And they were looking at this and they figured out like only 20% of the employees were actually using the AI tools they had in the company. And they got that up to around 72% now, which I found amazing.
I couldn't agree more. So like the reason why I started with tech is because obviously like they are, and we are a very tech-driven organization. I believe we have around 100 plus developers across the company. They account for a large chunk of our company, but they're also usually the people who adopt these tools faster than everyone else, because you know they're tech people. They know how to play around with the tools. They like to experiment different things. But we're also like even the team members that we have across different departments as well. They still work for a young tech company, and so they tend to be younger. You know, the average age around the organization is 30 years old. And so for us, implementing was relatively easier than, you know, a massive enterprise where people like are not very tech savvy, right?
Yeah.
And that's when we go back to the whole topic of, the vast majority of the AI pilot actually don't work. That's true, but that probably applies to large enterprise where the team is very bureaucratic, very bloated. You have a lot of like more experienced employees that are usually like against the change. Whereas for us, it's very like top down, no bureaucracy, a very lean team. And so we easily allow implementation across teams of AI tools. Having said that, we went through the same channel and we're still, it's a never ending exercise, right? I mean, you constantly need to get better at these tools. So far, some teams implemented more than the others, and we went through a very similar assessment. So we send out a survey assessing who was using what, and that helped us to also like put together the use cases. So 100%, I agree with that approach, and I believe that some departments such as finance and accounting will be less prone because they've been using the same tools such as SAP forever, and they're maybe like less eager to embark on new tools. And those are exactly the team that need a bit more of a push, and that's why we put together a team for AI implementation across the company, because some team members, like you say, they might just implement it on their own. Some others might need a bit of an encouragement and understand how important it can be, how better their output can be through the use of AI tools. So I agree with your statement.
Yeah, but internally, I understand you have a young team, average like 30 years, rather tech savvy. So you from the shop circle perspective, you think you're good. Then there's two more levers. The one is the acquired companies that you bring in. You said you can help them get up to speed on AI. And the third one for me would be, and that's a discussion I have frequently now, is the customers, right? So you can be as good in AI as you want, right? The question is then, at some point, do you recognize some kind of hurdles with your customers where you say like your product development gets faster and your products get better, but the customer doesn't keep pace in the speed of change?
Yeah, for sure. So you're right. So we have on one hand, answering to your question, within the products of ShubCircle, We have also a task force and a team to integrate AI functions across the portfolio. So on one hand, so far we discussed about, you know, implementing AI across operations, right? And that allow us to automate certain repetitive tasks in the department that I mentioned before. And then we have the more client-facing AI tools, which is an exercise that we are running constantly. And it's, again, a never-ending exercise because you constantly need to innovate your products. And that's one of the core functions of ShopCircle. We want to accelerate the pace of innovation after the acquisition. But so we have these teams to integrate AI functions across the portfolio. And so far, we have launched at least one AI feature across the overall portfolio. And answering your question, that's right. I mean, obviously, like enterprise, especially if they are in more traditional industries and verticals and run by more experienced people, they sometimes oppose innovation. But in the case of AI, I think everyone wants to be there. So like, you know, all the corporates have a budget at least for AI tools, which sometimes is separate from SaaS, right? You have one for technology and one for AI. And so then it's up to you to explain how to use it and what is the ROI that you can get by investing in the tools, in the AI tools that we offer as well. And step two then is the adoption and the implementation. So far, because we are launching AI features to our existing clients, testing it on existing products is working very well because they're used to a product and that's just an upgraded version of that. So it helps us to, you know, increase the net dollar retention, help our clients with additional things that we couldn't do before. There is definitely an element of a lot of people are asking for AI without understanding exactly what they're asking for. But there is also like the reality of companies wanting to invest more, getting smarter and smarter every day. The pace of innovation that we're looking at in AI is unprecedented. I think I've never seen something like that in my career. And so it will take some time. Someone smarter than me, Bill Gates used to say that we overestimate the pace of innovation within 2 years and we underestimate the pace of the impact of innovation within 10 years. And I really agree with that. So I think the trend is clear. It will take some time to get there. There will be bumps on the road. But over time, also because, you know, the younger generation will contribute to a higher percentage of the workforce, we'll all get there.
Okay. I know the quote. And I mean, for someone who basically went through the innovation of IT and having personal computers, which weren't there when I was younger, and then they came, and then we had the same thing with mobile phones, right? We've at least seen two really big technology changes, put the internet as well, maybe the third one. But yeah, I still can't really grasp this AI thing personally. I mean, as a trained computer scientist, I am scared a little bit of the opportunity of exponential growth in the smartness of the system. Yeah. So something that gets increasingly and exponentially smarter than human beings. I think that is something really hard to understand. And so I'm sitting here observing, but I really don't try to predict the future anymore. So let's see how that goes.
I'm not in a game of predicting the future as well. So because we usually like invest in traditional companies that have been around for more than 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not AI tools or ChatGPT wrappers, right? But my observation is more like there are already a lot of tools that can help you with many things. And we use them and we apply them across our organization. It's then where it will get, it's difficult to say, but for sure it will get smarter over time, right?
Yeah, that we can agree on. So now you said like also you have a quite young Workforce, you also said younger generation might pick up on trends. So that brings us to the topic of people, right? I imagine your company is kind of challenging from your CEO point of view, like getting the right team together, like acquiring other companies, integrating new companies at that pace and at that scale. That requires a totally broad skill set in your team. So how do you make sure to get the best people to Shop Circle and how do you set up your team? How does that work?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think it's one of the most important tasks for a founder, for a CEO, for the management in general is actually like hiring people. Because it's the only way that you can really like scale yourself, hiring people that you trust and can have a huge impact in the organization as well. For this reason, we have invested a lot in building a strong employer brand. Obviously, like the easiest way to invest a lot is people know that we treat employees fairly, and in a fast growing scale up, there are always opportunity to grow. So if the company goes well, you tend to attract stronger talents. At the moment, we for each opening that we have, we tend to like receive 500 application plus. And that obviously also like knowing that we have strong investor backing and real traction really help you to get inbound interest. So that allows us to be extremely selective. And usually, because we need to hire just one person out of like 500 applications that we receive, usually like our selection rate is obviously like less than, significantly less than 1%. And so, as I mentioned, as founders, we also spend a lot of time personally involved in recruiting, not only in the interview, but also like reaching out to the right person or like getting connected to the right person through someone, despite the company is now close to 300 people globally. Yeah. We believe that hiring and more importantly, retention are some of the most important things we can do to scale beyond a certain size, right? Otherwise, it will only be about myself and my co-founder, Gianmaria, and we're past that phase. And
no, I agree. I mean, you have like close to 300 people, you have three successful funding rounds, and your name spreads. I mean, if you've done 16 acquisitions, that also makes you yourself known, right? But let's move a couple of years back. I mean, your company's not that old. You launched 2021, or you started 2021, and then you launched out of a Thalesmos in 2022 with already a funding in your back. So that phase, I'm very interested because that's when you started. That's when people didn't know the employer brand because there wasn't a brand at all, right? And you still needed to bring in cool people and to get that funding. Let's understand that playbook. Why did you build for a year and why was it stealth mode and how did you get that funding?
Yeah, 100%. I wanted the real reason, Matthias, is I wanted the team to be very focused on what we were doing and to without distraction from the outside, because once you announce the round, people start thinking, okay, we made it. The press start writing about you, like other companies poach from you. And so I wanted the team to work under the radar for a while. And it wasn't a huge team at the time, so it was relatively easier to tell the 15, 20 people working for us and say, hey guys, we're going to do this in stealth. We don't want also like potentially like competitors to pick up on what we're doing at this early stage. Also because in the first year of every single organization on the planet, the company is very fragile. And we also wanted to control the narrative. And when we were coming out to the market with the round announcement and saying what we were doing, I wanted the message to be clear and structured. And, 1 month into the company, you barely have a website, you don't have a social presence, you don't have a strong team. It's just you and your co-founder. So we decided to wait 1 year and a bit. I think it was like 14 months.
Now looking back at that time, like would you do it the same way again? Would you recommend that to other founders to have like a year of development phase, stealth mode before you just go out there?
Yeah, reality is it definitely makes it harder, Matthias, to attract talents because especially in Europe, which is a bit more of a risk adverse environment, telling your mom and your dad, hey, mom, dad, I'm leaving McKinsey or
to work for this company that I cannot tell you.
This company, and then they ask you, where is the website? And they don't have one. Where is the LinkedIn page? And they don't have one. Makes it harder.
Yeah.
Although what we've done at the beginning was be super clear with our vision and mission with our employees. Be also clear that we had capital and we were not just random Italian guys in London going around with no money. We had some capital, some early bakers, so they knew that they were not taking a huge risk. And we also went a lot on hiring through connections, through, for instance, I was teaching for 5 years at ESCP Europe. Entrepreneurship has always been a passion of mine, but also what I was doing is also like getting some of the students of the MBA to come and join me later on, because I knew that they were looking for something. I knew that, you know, we needed certain positions. So hiring trusted people helps at the beginning. And it's something that I recommend everyone, right? I wouldn't go and out and after 2 days from starting the company, just looking for talents all over the world. I would start with people that you trust, who are highly referred by other people that you know, because you know that the culture that you build when you have 10, 15 people really propagates around across the whole company later on. So I would recommend it, but assume that it will be harder to convince talents to join your organization. And really, like in the first year, more than anything else, I think the job of the founder should be pitching, because you pitch to investor who never heard about you. So you don't have any cross credibility from anyone that have previously invested in the company. Pitching to employees who don't know that you raised capital, who don't know unless you tell them, but don't know that you made acquisition and you don't have a brand. So there is definitely being in stealth means that you have to do an extra effort in pitching. But at the same time, you definitely gain a lot from working in peace without distraction and being focused, all of us, on one goal and one objective. I don't know if going back, maybe with hindsight, like we would have done less than 1 year and a few months. But like, I definitely think it helps to operate a few months under the radar.
Okay. So we take that as an advice, but you dropped a secret hack there in between the lines. Just get a guest lectureship at one of the top MBAs, scan out the 200 MBA students, and then hire the top five. So, you know, you got a good touch.
Yeah, I mean, that was not the initial idea. Like,
No. All good. I'm just joking. I did my MBA at ESA in Barcelona, so not ESCP, but same thing. We had a class of 200, and I think all the good professors, especially the business and entrepreneurship professors, they had some businesses at the site where they would also use the talent of the school and give jobs and internship to the students, right? And
that's exactly right. Yeah. They're more practical universities. Yeah. You usually hear from professionals, which is also like what makes them good, by the way, because you studied like already before, you did a bachelor somewhere else, highly academic, like in Italy and Germany. I know, because I also studied for 1 year in Cologne. They're very academic, right? And then you do an MBA where it's more practical, and it really, I think the value added is that you deal with people that come from the professional world, right? And in this case, a lot of professors were, like you just said, coming from the world, and the students obviously are looking for jobs, so it's just a very good match.
Now, I have to ask one last question, and then we're also running out of time, but I can drop that. We'll definitely meet some of the Shop Circle team at the Artist Summit, so there will be opportunities to touch base. But now, like you just said, like we're not only two Italian guys looking for talent in London. So why did you choose London as a place? Why didn't you found in Italy, or why didn't you come to Berlin, the mother city of entrepreneurship in Germany? Like why was it London?
100%. So we were already there, Matthias. The reality is, you know, usually my co-founder started in consulting and I started in banking. Not surprisingly, right? Like the classic, and I, you know, we should speak about this in another podcast, but usually when you go to business schools in Europe, these are the jobs yes. that you ended up doing. Now, we might be discussing here for 1 hour about whether that's right or not, why in the US they go to work straight away for startups, scale-ups, or start their company straight away. But at least like 12 years ago, that was the usual path. You were getting an MBA and go to work for you know, either banking or consulting or big tech. So, and most of these opportunities, and that was before Brexit, they were gravitating around London also because I did study in Germany, but when I studied there, it was in English, so I couldn't speak German. My French is also like pretty poor. And between Italy and England, London had way more opportunities because it's usually leveraged as a European headquarter, and that was before Brexit. Even now it's still like this, but a bit yeah. less for American companies. But then at the same time, also like the VC market yeah. Or the investor market in London, and that was different 12 years ago than it is now. It was much stronger in London, right? If you just look at amount of funding or you just look at amount of unicorns, the number in the UK was much higher than anywhere else in Europe. Now it's changing. Germany is catching up. France is catching up. Italy is starting from a smaller basis, but also like catching up. And when it comes to talents, there is no difference. I mean, if anything, people like in Germany, the cost of work is a bit lower. So probably makes sense to hire people in Germany and in Italy. These are the countries that I have experience on relative to sometimes the UK, because, you know, you also get easier access to talents because there is less competition. There are not as many American companies poaching from these countries. And so now we have a diversified team. We're also like, we have four openings right now in Milan, in Italy, where we're also like ramping up a team and calling you from the London office. So now that we're larger, we do have presence across different countries in Europe. But I think it worked out for us. It was the right decision because it gave us the right access to American funding as well. And London, in the space that we were targeting, so software or also like digital adoption was ahead the rest of Europe in terms of like internet penetration.
Okay, cool. Now this is great stuff, Luca. I think it's a very exciting story you're telling, like from basically just taking an idea that's been there and just saying like, look, we bring a different spin to it. We're acquiring software companies, B2B focus, we're bringing them together. Now we're applying not only excellent execution, these days also a spike in AI, and that gives us an edge. And then we're approaching somewhere $20 to $100 billion playbooks and see where we get there. And even if you only make 50% of the way, I think you'll be very, very successful. So I wish you all the best. In building Shop Circle to a software portfolio that's stellar, and I think I learned that you're very, very focused on this topic, that you apparently are super into these tech stories, but with the financial background of doing like an M&A game, which essentially this is. So yeah, super happy that you took the time sharing the story. I think I would say you named a lot of competitors and examples. I think there's less of them in the German market or in the German, Austrian, Switzerland market that I know of like this buy and build strategy. So it's good to have this insight from the UK. And maybe there's some companies that would like to learn more. As I said, a couple of you guys will be at the summit. Otherwise, reach out to me. I'll connect you to Luca. And then let's see where this goes. And yeah, wish you all the best.
Thanks a lot, Matthias. Very good summary. And I look forward to see you all at the summit. And great job for what you're doing and the community that you're building.
Thanks.